Now we're holding on page 36 in Bava Metzia, beginning Elo Metzia's Perek Sheni, middle of Oz Aleph. Forgot to mention yesterday, by the way, in connection with the story of the two Chachamim and their argument and the column in the Beis Medrash, the central column, splitting Hakosev points out over here a great lesson we can learn from this in Avodah, in Amunah. They saw that something went wrong. They saw that the cedar column split. Their first thought is not, well, let's go blame the builder, or let's figure out how much, you know, how long it's going to be before it's going to be repaired. Their first reaction is something. We must have done something wrong over here, and therefore the Eved made this happen. Okay, so now Elul Matzias, yeah. That's the thing, because that we are Yid realizes. A Yid realizes that everything that happens is Ashgacha Pratis. So they realize that it wasn't just a random thing that this happened. There must have been a reason behind it, especially that it should disrupt the Beis Medrash. Yeah, they can conclude it by themselves, because that's the way a Yid should think, that any time he sees something happen, he should realize that there's a reason behind it and try to figure out what that was.
There's a few stories like that. So
there's a lot of stories like that, yeah. Yeah, that someone saw something.
Well-known thing that happens.
Yeah.
No, that's when there is an argument, something happens in the Beis Medrash.
Well, that's true, but not that's true, but that's true. You have, for example, a story in the Gemara where one time two of the Chachamim were arguing and accidentally ripped up a Sefer Torah in the heat of the argument. So, yeah, and then afterwards the result was eventually that shul unfortunately became a base of Avodah Zarah later on. But, yeah, so there are such things, but we're not just talking about columns splitting and things like that. We're talking about anything in general. You should be trained to that everything that happens, there's a reason for it. It's not just random, yeah. and try to figure out what the reason behind it is in terms of people's mindset. Okay, so now turning to Elul Matzias Perek Sheni, so it starts talking about, of course, it continues talking about Dinim of Hashavas Aveda. So a major sugya at the beginning of it is the matter of Yir Shlomi Das. If you find something that you don't know whether the owner had given up hope of getting it yet, and if he hasn't, then you have to return it. If it has a simen, you have to try to return it. If it has a simen, and otherwise you can keep it. So it's a whole machlokas Yir Shlomi Das. If you don't know whether he had Yirsh yet, and later on, so let's say you. You pick it up then, and you find afterwards that before you had ever picked it up, the guy had you. So you're allowed to keep it or not. So it's machlokas abaya and rabba. In the end, this is one of the few cases where the halacha is like abaya. So in the course of the whole discussion, the Gemara mentions the following point. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shmuel ben Yehoi Tzadok, minayin la'aveda sheshot for nahar, how do we know that a lost object that was swept away by a river, shehi muteret, that it's mutter for a person to keep, even if it has a simen? Dichtiv, so the reason is, because the Pasuk says, kein tas l'chamorei, the Pasuk describes how you have to do Hashavas Aveda, this is what you should do for his donkey, v'chein tas l'simlosei, this is what you should do for his garment, v'chein tas l'chalaveda sachicha asher toved mimenu, this is what you should do for any lost thing of your brother, your fellow Yid, that is lost from him, u'mefsasa, and you find it, that you have to try to return it. Now, later on in the parak, the Gemara explains why it mentions specifically a chamorei and a simla, but the point is that the Pasuk is saying that when you find something that belonged to a fellow Yid, you have to try and then you have to return it. Now, what's this word, asher toved mimenu? Why does it have to say that it's lost from him? Who else would it be lost from? It means, we learn from that, we darshan from it. Misha avuda mimenu, when do you have to return it? When it's lost from him, or metsuya etzo kaladam, but it's findable by other people. So then, we'll say, then the Torah is saying, he lost it, he doesn't know where it is, but you found it, therefore you have a responsibility to return it. Yotzos is new, as opposed to this case, when it was swatted away by a river, it's lost from him, and it's not accessible by anybody else either. So in other words, there was a point when it was inaccessible to everybody, and therefore it becomes hefker. We assume that he had yirsh. We assume that he had yirsh, and even if we don't know specifically that kind of case, the Torah allows us to consider that he had yirsh because b'derech hateva he's not getting it back.
Yeah, even if it's washed ashore.
So even if at some point, later point, it's washed ashore, but there was a period of time when it was inaccessible, and now you can still go l'fnim ashur sadin. The Gemara talks about that later in the parak, but mi'ikra din, at that point, you're allowed to keep it. So that's the thing. The Gemara brings this in connection with this machloit, this abaya and rabba. And it points out that only in this, basically the implication is only in this case are we saying that you're allowed to keep it because we assume that there was yirsh, but otherwise not, showing that you can't assume yirsh otherwise, so therefore we slug up Rava and we show that the halacha is like, I buy a yirsh, shalemi das is not valid yirsh, meaning in other words, you can't take the thing unless you know for a fact that the owner has had yirsh from it. So you can have a case like this. You have certain other cases where we have a strong reason to assume that there was yirsh. The Gemara goes through a number of them in the sugya and elsewhere in the perek. There are cases where we have a legal right to assume that there was yirsh. But if we don't have that and we don't know that there was yirsh, then we can't. There is, by the way, a vort they say on that, on this expression, yirsh shalomi das. Literally, it means giving up hope, not from das. So there's a well-known vort on it that says that alone teaches us a certain lesson in avodah, yirsh, that a person should give up and thinks the situation is hopeless, is shalomi das. It comes from a lack of das, from not realizing that the Eibishter runs the world and a situation is never truly hopeless. In terms of halacha, yirsh shalemi das means that you don't know whether the owner has had yirsh, whether he's given up hope of getting back this object. Okay. Further on, the Gemara discusses a point. Now, the Mishnah gives a list of things that, by assumption, you're allowed to keep because these are things that don't have a simen. And therefore you're allowed to keep them. One example is that you have one example the Mishnah gives is kikris shel nachtoim, loaves of bread from a baker. You go, let's say, imagine you go to the store, you buy a loaf of bread. It looks like every other loaf out there. They're all made in the same shape. So there's no simen on it. So now you find such a loaf of bread in the street, then there's no simen, and you can assume that the owner had yirsh and you can keep it. So the Gemara has a whole discussion about that and about various details about what about if an object that's likely to be stepped on or an object that may have what about an object, let's say, that has a simen on it, but it's likely to be trampled and the simen is going to get lost. Is such a thing considered a valid simen? If you happen to find it before the simen has been rubbed out, do you have to return it or not? So the Gemara has a whole sugya on that point. What about if the thing is likely to be moved around, kicked around in Rosh Hashanah from place to place? Is that considered a simon? And so the Gemara has a whole sugya and a whole machlokas on the subject. In the course of it, it mentions this point about that you don't have to return loaves of bread from a commercial baker because they all look the same, but you do have to return ones from a balabayas. Individual people bake their bread in different shapes and all, and therefore it's recognizable that it comes from a certain person. So the Gemara mentions Amalach Rabba, so Rabba, who says that generally speaking, a simon on an object that's going to get kicked around or trampled on is not considered a simon. He'll say, "Hosam hainu taima." You know why? The reason is in the case of certain cases with loaves of bread, you have to return them. Mishum de'en ma'avirin ala uchlin, because you're not allowed to pass by food without and leave it on the ground. If you see food on the ground, you right away have to pick it up. Therefore, let's say, for example, the Gemara discusses a few possibilities. You can have where hold on. You have a case where there's a simon on it. Let's say there's a tag on it, and that simon may get stomped on, for example, by people and rubbed out. You also have a case, for example, where the thing may have been dropped in one place in Rosh Hashanah, and then in the course of this traffic, this foot traffic and all, and it gets kicked around and ends up in a different part of Rosh Hashanah.
You can see it, so you got to return it.
So that's the thing. The Gemara discusses, hold on. The Gemara explains that sometimes you have a simen, it's called simen ha'osui lidoris. You have a simen which is likely to be trampled on. So therefore, we can say that maybe it's not considered a real simen. The owner, if he drops something that has that kind of simen, is likely to have yirsh right away because he's going to figure it's soon going to be stomped on and rubbed out by foot traffic.
So therefore,
the person who picks it up would be able to, so therefore he doesn't have to return and he may be able to keep it. But again, then there are certain... Essentially, you have to know whether this is a simon or silidaris, yeah. So then, you also have the point, so again, one thing that comes up in this connection is that you have to return loaves of bread that were baked by an individual person. So the question is why? Isn't that simon or silidaris? Isn't it likely that people will trample on it and it won't be noticeable anymore what the original shape was? And the answer is, Amalach Rabbah, Hossam, Hain, Taima. You know what the reason is? Mishum de'en because when you see food in the street, you're not allowed to just leave it there. You have to pick it up right away. out of respect for food that the Eibishter gave us. Therefore, it's not likely that bread is going to get trampled on or kicked around in the street. The likelihood is, when you find it, it's going to be shortly after the person dropped it, and he hasn't yet had yirsh, and the simen, as in the shape of the bread and the and then and whatever, is still going to be intact, and therefore you have to return it. So Tosfos references in this connection of Gemara in Eruvin that also mentions this point of Ein Ma'avirin Al Oichlin. Well, there it's clear. So here in all Gemara, you could maybe conceivably understand that it means that if it weren't for Ein Ma'avirin Al Oichlin, you'd be able to trample it. But Tosfos points out, based on other Gemara, it means not only you're not allowed, not just a chiddush that you can't trample on the food, you can't even just pass it by. As soon as you see it, you have to pick it up out of respect for food. And Tosfos proves that from the way the Gemara tells the story in Eruvin over there. Rabbi Levi Yitzchok, the Rebbe's father, has a cute vort on it. In that Gemara in Eruvin, Rabbi Gamliel sees some bread on the road, and he tells his Talmud, Rabbi Loi, to pick it up because Ein Ma'avirin Al Oichlin. So Rabbi Levi develops the point that Rabbi Gamliel symbolically is like Avraham Avinu, and what do we find by Avraham? He tells his guests in Parshas at the beginning of Vayera, when he has the three Malachim as guests. He says, I'm going to serve you pas lechem, I'll serve you a piece of bread, achar ta'avoru, and then you can pass by. So in the simple sense, he's saying, in other words, that I'm going to give you some food, and then you can go to wherever you're heading off to. But Rav Levick says, there's a remez in it. Avraham is saying, if there's food, if there's bread in the street right now, I have to pick it up first, ve'echa pas lechem, and only then, achar ta'avoru, then you can continue passing by, because otherwise, ein ma'avirin al oichlin.
That's probably solid.
Well, Sokol Yisalem is something else. That's the mitzvah specifically by Shavuos Aveda, yes, that you can't ignore it.
Right,
but what we're saying over here is, in other words, the fact is, there might be foot traffic. People might not notice that there's bread there. Okay. Further on, the Gemara talks about like this. The Mishnah says, Rav Shimon Elazar says in the Mishnah that you don't have to make an announcement about clay on Puria. All of this, by the way, was in Rambam a couple of days ago in Hilchos Gzeila Ba'aveda. Anyway, so you have like this. Rav Shimon Elazar says in the Mishnah that you don't have to announce clay on Puria. Clay on Puria, the Gemara says, means kalim that are new and they're made in a standard size or style or whatever. So imagine, like, you know, for example, let's say you're walking in the street, let's say, and you find a cup, let's say, you find something like that, where they're all the stores sell zillions of the same thing and they all look identical. So there's no simen on it. Mela, if you use it for a while, then you eventually have a simen on it by scratches and dents or whatever. But when it's new, then you don't. The word Ampuria itself, Rashi explains, is short for Ein Poiraya, which means there's no proof over here. There's no evidence that it belongs to this particular person. It means new kalim, right. So it's Pharisee Israel points out that also the word Ampuria is related to a Greek word for a store. Like you have in English, you have the word Emporium. Is a fancy word for a store, so it means it's kalim that are new from the store, and you haven't yet gotten used to the look of them. So the Gemara asks, wait a second, so what are we talking about? So apparently this kalim has no simen. Well, what's the difference then, whether it's new or old? Even if it's old, it doesn't necessarily have a simen on it. And the answer is, the Gemara explains, that we're talking about what Rav Shimon Elazar is referring to is if you realize that this kalim is owned by a Talmid Chacham. Now, a Talmid Chacham, usually a regular person has to give simonim in order to be able to claim a lost object. He has to be able to specifically say the size of it or particular marking on it or whatever. A Talmid Chacham, we give him leeway. As the Gemara is going to say now, a Talmid Chacham tells the truth. So when he says that I recognize this keli on sight, he might not be able to give specific simonim on it, but he looks at it and says, yes, I recognize it, then we can return it to him. So now, Rav Shimon Elazar says, if the keli is old, then you do have to announce it because the owner might be a Talmid Chacham. But if it's new, you don't have to because even the Talmid Chacham is not going to recognize it yet because it's new and it's just recently bought from the store. So now, in this connection, the Gemara explains, why can we trust a Talmid Chacham like that? Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Bahani Tlas Mili Avidi Rabbanan D'Meshano B'Diburayhu U'B'Milayhu. Only in the following three things are the Chachamim accustomed to changing their words, meaning they don't say the full truth when it comes to these three things. But everything else they do, and therefore if he says that I recognize this keli, then we have to return it to him. The three things are the Masechta, as far as a Masechta. Now each of these things, there's a few different explanations of what it means. So first let's go with Rashi. The Masechta means if they ask him, are you thoroughly familiar with this Masechta? So he can answer no, even if he is in fact familiar with it, because of anivus. So he doesn't want to boast that he knows it. The second one, bapuria. Puria means a bed. So Rashi explains, if they ask him, did you have relations recently? Then he should answer no, because that's midas tznius. It's a tzniustic thing to not tell other people when he had relations. Why somebody would ask him such a question, we'll get back to that point in a minute. And the third thing, uva ushpiza, and as far as a host. So Rashi says, if they ask the Talmud Chacham, especially many times, Talmud Chachamim in those days would often board out of town and then learn an out-of-town yeshivas. So if they ask him, what was your host like? Did he welcome you? Was he accommodating? Then it's a good midah to say no. Why not? Because you don't want other people to come take advantage of the guy.
Is there anybody, as the Mishnah says, a guest can't invite a guest?
That's something else. That's true, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about this Talmud Chacham has been boarding by somebody in town. Now other people ask him, is this a good person to be a guest by? Then he can say no, because if he says yes, then they're going to start taking advantage of him. They're going to figure, hey, he's a Machnas Erdach. We'll go and eat him out of house and home.
By anybody. Why don't you come to home?
So, because a regular person, and the point is, a regular person, we can't trust that he's only changing his word in these three things. A regular person might lie about other things as well. But a Talmud Chacham, we know, is going to alter the truth when it comes to these three things. Therefore, when he says that this Keli, I recognize this Keli as being mine, even though he doesn't have a simen, even though he only has what's called Tvias Ayin, he recognizes it on sight, that's good enough reason to return it for him. Now.
What about the Aaron? When it was changing...
So we'll talk about that in a second. So first of all, Tosfos goes through the three things as follows. First of all, as far as the Masechta, so Tosfos explains that when a person is coming to ask him for a din or a teaching in Torah or for him to learn or whatever, then you have to tell him straight out. Then v'shinantam, shiyu dibre Torah v'chodon in meficha, then there's no false anivus, you have to tell him what you know. Here, they're Stam asking, do you know how to learn this? So therefore, he's not obligated to respond, to respond that he actually knows that he can, as Rashi says, out of anivus say that he doesn't know it.
If he says no, then the person might have a question.
We have to try to evaluate why is the person coming. Let's say, for example, no, but let's say you can tell sometimes. Hold on. Okay, let's say
you know it. What he's asking because he has a question.
Okay, so maybe you could say why. So fine, you could always say why do you need to know. If he says stam out of curiosity is one thing. Another possibility, you could have the other way around. You say no. Oh, you know that's disappointing. I wanted to ask you a question in Hilchos such and such. Oh well, actually then fine, I do know it. You could do something like that. Yeah, possibilities like that. The Rambam also says you can have, let's say for example, right now he's busy with one masechta and he doesn't want people bothering him with shilas on a different one. Let's say. Iye Hayam on the side over here brings yet another possibility that it might mean, for example, that he's planning to learn a particular masechta, but then he changes his mind and decides to learn a different masechta instead. That's fine. It's not considered a lie. If he had decided, I plan to learn masechta such and such, and then for him to change his mind, for whatever reason, it's not considered a lie. That's one meaning.
That's for himself. So
for example, he's telling other people. He tells somebody else. Let's say that if he committed to learning with somebody else, that's different. But so let's say for example, Yom says that people have said, we're going to learn a certain masechta, and he at first decides to go along with them, and then he chooses to learn a different one. Then they shouldn't be makbid and say that he lied. They're allowed to give him that leeway. They should give him that leeway. The second thing, puria, which we said means a bed. By the way, Maharsha points out another point over here as well. Bechlau, you have an expression in the Gemara, Lamed l'shon chaloyma eni yedea. Teach your tongue to say, I don't know. Shema tisbada, because otherwise you may be shown to be a liar. So in other words, it's better for him to say, now again, if he's being asked a practical question in halacha, there's no room for false anivus over there, but like this, if they're asking him, do you know such and such, he could very well say, I don't know, in order that then they're not going to ask him a question and he's going to be shown up as taka not knowing the answer. So that's legitimate. The next one, bapuria. Now, Rashi had said puria means a bed, as if they ask him, did you do tashmish amita? Tosfos says, who would ask a person such a thing? So rather, Tosfos says, no, what we mean is, Suppose, for example, he was a Baal Keri and he didn't come to the Beis Medrash, because back when you had Takonas Ezra, in effect, then a person is not allowed to learn Torah until he Torahed. So now, they ask him, why weren't you here in the Beis Medrash yesterday? So instead of saying that I was a Baal Keri, he can give an excuse that I was sick or some other kind of emergency like that. And that's not considered a lie. Then Rashi says another possibility, Tosfos rather says, another possibility, they ask him, did you sleep on this particular bed? So now he can say no. Why? Because they might find Zera on it, they might find Shechlas Zera on it, and now it would be embarrassing to him. So he's allowed to say that he didn't sleep on that bed. Within the idea that it's a bed, Yom says another possibility. It may mean that they ask him, he plans to sleep on a certain bed, and then he finds, for whatever reason, that particular place is dangerous, and he chooses another bed, then that's not considered a lie, the fact that he changes that. Marsha says another possibility, Michal. The word Puria does not necessarily have to mean a bed. Another meaning of Puria is Purim, like Chayavidish, Levasumi Bapuria. So if they ask him, it's Purim, are you drunk enough yet to be that you don't know between Oru Haman and Baruch Mordechai, then he can say yes, even if he's truly not, so that they don't ply him with more alcohol. Okay, so that's Puria. Uvo Shpiza. So again, you know, as Rashi said, he doesn't want to praise his host too much because then other people will take advantage of him. Tosfos explains it depends who he's talking to. If he's talking to Erlecha people, by all means, let him praise the host. They're not going to go take advantage of such a person. Adrabba, let him praise him. Kol Masha Torach Balabais. Everything that the Balabais did, he did only for my sake. But here you're talking about that he's talking to not Menschlecha people, and therefore there's a concern they're going to take advantage.
The regular person is, how was the food there? It was great. Are you allowed to say that?
So that's the thing. So Tosfos is saying you have to evaluate. The Talmud Chacham is going to have to evaluate. Is this other person?
The regular person.
Oh, so that what we're saying is, if somebody asks you whether the food in a certain place is good, you're going to have to consider, are they likely to take advantage of the host because of that? If it's a restaurant, for example, by all means, if it was good food, say so. The restaurant would like the business. But if it's talking a private balabus and you had a good Shabbos meal over there, it might not be so good to play it up, because then he's going to start having a lot more requests for guests more than he can handle. Now, obviously, if we know that he's a machnas urach and he wants as many guests as possible, then it's different. So, yeah, the point is you've got to evaluate. The point is there are circumstances where it's appropriate to do that. Marshall says another point. There's a place where the Gemara mentions in Chulin that people in Pumpadissa, many people in Pumpadissa, were dishonest. And therefore, if you have, the Gemara says, if you have somebody, if you're traveling on the road and you happen to meet up with a person from Pumbedissa and he finds out where you're staying, find a different place to stay. Because otherwise he's going to go and rob you. So he's going to go break into where you're staying and rob you. So by all means, tell him to begin with that I'm staying in a different place so you don't have that problem. What?
It's like,
One
of the Amoras was the rabbi
yet. So we learned in Kedushin, actually, we learned that Rabbi Yehuda was the Rosh Yeshiva in Pumbedissa. What actually happened was one of the central yeshivas of Bavel was at first located in Nauda. Shmuel was the Rosh Yeshiva there. But after that, a few years later, Nauda was destroyed and the yeshiva moved to Pumbedissa. One possibility, maybe Taka, why Rabbi Yehuda moved it, why Pumbedissa, Dafka was a big, heavily Jewish city, but another reason Taka may have been, because he knows the people over there have such bad minutes, maybe he wanted to elevate them by having a yeshiva among them. So therefore, these are three things. Now, Tosfos says, yeah, you're asking what about Aaron HaKohen going in and then changing things in order to make people make peace. Tosfos says that these are all matters of Darchei Shalom. But these are more common. In general, a person is allowed to be Mishanim Mipnei Darchei Shalom. We learned from last week's parasha where Sarah laughs and says, how can we have a baby? Avraham is old, and Hashem changes and says, and then says to Avraham, why did Sarah say, I am old? In order not that Avraham shouldn't feel insulted. Right, so Tosfos says these are all matters of Darchei Shalom. But the Gemara is mentioning these because these are the most common examples of Darkei Shalom. But in fact, anything else where it's saying Darkei Shalom would be acceptable. There's other Mephoshim who learn, actually, that's even more so. These three things, the Talmud Chacham is allowed to change the truth. But when it comes to Darkei Shalom, he has to. So therefore, it's not in this category over here, because here we're saying only Avidi Rabbanim. They're used to doing it, so they're not absolutely required to, but in the case of Darkei Shalom, they're absolutely required to. then.
No, so we're saying
Again, we're saying that any other person, we don't know whether he might lie about other things as well. A Talmid Chacham, we can be guaranteed, is going to be only changing the truth, and after, it's even changing the truth, by the way. A number of Mefarshim point out the Gemara's expression is Dimishanu v'diburayu. They change in their wording, meaning they don't say an outright lie. They say something which could be misconstrued as being something else. And Beni Hoyada gives an example of it, and he says also the word avidi. The word avidi means that they're accustomed to, but it also means, he says, they make. So like the Chachamim make, they make a phrase that they can use, that they can answer the question without outright lying. And he gives an example. For example, Gemara and Shabbos, where the Sultan confronts Moshe Rabbeinu after Matan Torah and says, where's the Torah? I know, didn't you receive it from Hashem? And I want to know where it is. And Moshe, so to speak, I don't know if you should say this about Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe kind of like plays dumb and says, who am I that the Torah should be given through me? So like, in other words, to evade the question. So he's not outright saying, I didn't receive the Torah. He's pretending like, well, who am I to, yeah. So. Why is that? Because the Sultan is asking, you don't just fob him, or you have to fob him off with something. Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara continues. So the Gemara continues in this connection. Mazutra chasida igniv lekosa de kaspa meushpiza. One time a silver cup was stolen from a place where Mazutra chasida was staying. And they didn't know who the thief was. Then Mavzutra noticed one of the Talmidim, the Moshi Yodeh, he washed his hands, the Nugget Beglima de Chavre, and he wiped his hands, dried his hands on somebody else's garment. Omar, so Mavzutra realizes to himself, this must be the thief, because we see he's not concerned about somebody else's money, about somebody else's property. Maybe he wants to dry his hands on his own clothing, that's one thing, but what is he doing on somebody else's clothing? So he tied him up to give him malchus, or a different explanation is that he forced him by threatening him with a cherem. But Oidi, and the guy confessed that he was the thief. So one point is, Mefarshim explained, the reason why the Gemara brings in the story is here's another thing. Here we're saying that you can trust the Talmid Chacham about a found object, that if he says, I recognize it, then you can return it to him just based on his recognition, provided, as we said, that he's a Talmid Chacham who doesn't lie except about the few things that we said before. But also, here's another point, if we see that he's not careful with somebody else's mammon, then also we can't return a lost object to him based on Tevi'as Ayin, because now we have to be concerned, like this Talmud, that he might be taking something that's not doesn't belong to him. Then Yoda makes an interesting point over here, that the Rashi, now the expression in the Gemara is igniv lei kosa de kaspa mirshpiza. Now literally that could mean that it was stolen from him a silver cup in a lodging. So that might mean that it was Mazutra's own cup. However, Rashi takes care to say that it wasn't his own kli shaloshpiza. It was a cup that belonged to the host. So Ben Yoyada points out, why is that important to know? Why can't we assume that it was Mazutra's own cup? And he brings in this connection a famous story involving the Shalor HaKadosh. The gist of the story is that one time some silver spoons or something like that was stolen from the Shalor's house, and suspicion fell on a certain Talmud, and the upshot was the Talmud was so embarrassed that he left town, and eventually Shmadzich, Rachman Watzlan. Many years later, the Shalor HaKadosh was a rav in various cities in Europe. Eventually, when he got older, he decided to move to Eretz Yisrael. To make a long story short, when he's in Eretz Yisrael, he ends up getting called in or arrested or something. I forget the exact detail by the governor of Yafo. On the face of it, this governor would be an Arab or a Turk, like all the others were in those times. He threatened to kill the Shalor. And he's saying vidui and everything, and then instead of killing him, the guy bent over and kissed him on the neck where you would expect him to put the sword. And the Shalor was astonished what's going on, and the guy says, I'm your old Talmud after that whole story with the spoons. I was very embarrassed. I left town. I shmadzach, and I went from one place to another, and I wound up over here, and I'm the governor of Yafo here. But he says, basically, because you put suspicion on me, and the fact's true, I was guilty, but because you publicized it, and that caused me embarrassment, is why I was decided, min hashamayim, that you're going to have to go through this whole experience in order to be mechaper for it. So now, Ben Yoyada explains, in the same vein, if it was Mazutra's own cup, then he would know not to make that mistake. He wouldn't go out the Talmud. Fine, he'll know in person that this Talmud is untrustworthy. But when it's the host's cup, then it's another matter. First of all, he can't play games like that. But second of all, after all, the host is going to suspect all of them. He's going to think that all Talmud Chachamim are guilty or dishonest or in cahoots with one another. So therefore, he has no choice but to expose the Ganav. Further on, the Gemara talks about the point that if an object has been lost for 12 months or more, then you don't technically have to return it. After 12 months, we assume the owner has had yush. By the way, we have to realize the Perek discusses quite a bit, not just things that are lost, as in a person knew where they were and then he dropped them or whatever and lost track of them. Sometimes it can also be something which a person left behind and we don't know whether he plans to come back and get it. So after 12 months, we can assume that he's abandoned it. So the Gemara tells, so technically after 12 months, you usually don't have to. However, the Gemara says, Avur de Shmuel, Ashkach Hani Chamri B'Mavra, the father of Shmuel one time found some donkeys in the desert, Va'adrinu L'Marayhu, and he returned them to their owner, L'Bosa Treser Yavche Shata, after 12 months had passed. And the reason was, L'Fnim Mishra Sadin, in order to go L'Fnim Mishra Sadin, as we learned before, and as we're going to learn later on, that it's important to do that, and not to stick to Midas Sadin. How did he know they'd been there for 12 months? So one explanation is that he had seen them many months earlier. He'd seen them a year earlier in this grazing in this area. And he figured at the time, well, the owner probably knows where they are. He probably sent them out to graze around here and they're not lost. But now, eventually, a year later, he saw them still in the same area. So, of course, the owner wouldn't have left them out there for so long. So, therefore, it must be that they're lost. Tosfos gives a different point that later on in the Perek it talks about that when you find an animal, now unlike, for example, let's say you find a keli, so generally speaking, all you need to do is put it away in a closet and wait until the owner comes. Meanwhile, you put out advertisements or you announce or whatever, as it discusses later in the Perek, how to do it exactly. Sometimes you need to use the keli for a certain amount, but the point is it doesn't really cost you anything to have the keli in your possession. But if it's an animal, it's different. You got to feed it, you got to take care of it. So therefore, the Mishnah later on in the Perek describes, if you find an animal, how long do you have to keep it before, in hopes that the owner is going to come, before there comes a certain point when you're allowed to sell the animal, basically evaluate the value of the animal, sell it, and then put away the money and wait until the guy comes to collect the money. So now, though, according to Tosfos, the point of what Avur de Shmuel did, L'Fnim Mishra Sadin, is he kept on to the actual animals themselves and fed them and took care of them and everything, even though he wasn't strictly speaking responsible to do that. He could have just sold them and then kept the money until the owner comes.
You find a garment, take care of it for you.
So that's the thing. So it's not that you have to take care of it for you. Generally speaking, you find something. No, so that's the thing. You find something. We're saying up to a year, we assume the owner is still looking for it. After a year, we assume he's had use. Right, but you're right. Yeah, later on in the Perek, it describes, for example, you find a garment, you have to shake it out once every 30 days. We're going to have later on a piece of En Yaakov that refers to that. Yeah, the general rule is you find an inanimate object, you have to do things with it every so often to keep it from getting rusty or moldy or whatever it is, right? With certain exceptions. You find, for example, it says you find a gold keli, you don't do anything with it because gold doesn't rust or tarnish or anything. Just set it aside, put it away for safekeeping in a closet or wherever you store valuables, in a safe, wherever you store valuables like that, and just leave it until the owner shows up, right?
After a
year, in principle, you don't have to because at that point we assume the owner was Miyash, yeah. Further on, the Gemara discusses, has a long discussion of the question of whether the whole concept of returning lost objects based on a simen is daraisa or derabanan. And the point is, the Gemara says, a nafkamina of it is, we talked about in the previous parak, we talked about yesterday, returning a get that you find. The question is, can you do that based on simonim? If you say that simonim are daraisa, then sure, you can do that. If you say simonim are only derabanan, then you can't return a get, which after all is whether who you're returning to has implications on a daraisa level. So the Gemara has a whole sugya on the subject. In the course of it, the Gemara brings the following point. The pasuk says, "V'hoya imcha ad droish achicha oisai." You should keep the object with you until literally ad droish achicha oisai. The simple meaning means until your brother investigates it, meaning until your brother, your fellow yid, comes looking for it, and then you return it for him. But the word ad droish achicha we can also understand to mean until investigation of your brother. So in other words, so the question is like this. What is the simple meaning of the pasuk? So you should keep it until your fellow yid comes seeking, comes searching for it. The question is, well, of course, how could you possibly give it to him before he seeks for it? Obviously, you have to wait until somebody comes with a claim that this is mine. How else are you going to return it? Ella, we learn the pasuk, Joshehu. It means investigate him, im ramai hu, im lav, or ein ramai, or to find out whether he's a swindler or not. So in other words,
you have to wait till the person comes.
Well, you obviously have to wait till the person comes, because, you made an announcement. You found an object, you made an announcement in your shalayim, as we're going to learn later on, or in shul, or you put an ad in the newspaper or whatever, and eventually somebody comes knocking on your door, or somebody comes and WhatsApps you and whatever, and says, I lost this thing, I want to come and give some money for it. Obviously, before a person contacts you, you have nobody to return it to, right? So why does the pasuk have to say, Adrei Shachicha Oisai? So that's what we're explaining, that it means there's another meaning in the pasuk. You have to investigate him whether he's a swindler. You have to find out. So that's the point. Somebody comes claiming this thing, the Gemara brings this braisa, that you have to find out whether he's a swindler before you can return it to him. So that's the thing. The Gemara brings the... Hold on. So the Gemara explains, this is in the course of a discussion about simonim. So the Gemara says, maybe that's what it means. Maybe you have to investigate him, make sure he gives good, valid simonim, not just generic simonim, but specific ones. But the Gemara says, maybe not necessarily. Maybe it actually means that in order for you to return it to him, he would actually, on a daraisa level, he would have to bring edim that it was his. Yeah. So as I said, the Gemara goes through a whole sugya on the subject. Later on, by the way, it mentions, we'll have a piece next time we learn Ein Yaakov, Es Hashem, we have a piece. There was a point in history when there were so many swindlers that the Chachamim had to make a takana that whenever a person is coming to claim a lost object, he has to bring character witnesses. He has to bring perfect witnesses, not that he owns the object, but at least witnesses that he is an honest person.
After the guy makes the announcement, I found some. How long do you have to?
So that's a later piece. That's the next piece. So I think we'll get to that next piece next time, Ben Sashem. Yeah. Okay. Yom Mashiach Gola. Chavdeiz Cheshvin. We were talking about, the Rebbe was talking about yesterday in a letter about how we talk about Ikvos Meshicha, and we talk about all the seemingly negative things that are going to be there, and the chutzpah, and the inflation, and so on and so forth. So we talked about yesterday, the Rebbe explains in a letter that there's a positive side to each of these things. For example, we said the Ne'orim Pneis Kenim Yabinu means even you have people who are relatively speaking juniors in knowledge of Torah, they're going to have the breakkeit to turn to the seniors, the ones who have learned much more than them, and tell them there's places in Avodah where you can improve. So now that ever continues, there's another piece from that Mishnah as well that's relevant. The Mishnah says that an ikvis mishicha bas koma be'ima, a daughter will stand up against her mother. So in the face of it, it means, in other words, that a daughter will be chutzvedik towards her mother. But now, the Rebbe also says, in avoida, what does that mean? That within the household itself, let's say, for example, there was something that people were makelin in the house because, for example, in earlier times it was hard to be. An example that Rebbe talked about in a sicha in later years is, for example, lighting Shabbos candles. It used to be common that unmarried girls lit Shabbos candles, but then over the years, because times were hard and they couldn't always afford, so the minhag in many places dropped the meaning of unmarried girls lighting. So let's say you have things like that where they were coolest because of the difficult conditions people were living in. So what happens now? As the Mishnah says, Bas Kom, it's actually based on a pasuk, Bas Kom Be'ima, a daughter stands up against her mother, and a Kala, a daughter-in-law, Bachamoisa, against her mother-in-law, and says, no, we have to act the proper way in these things as well. Never mind that until now my mother or my mother-in-law was doing differently. Now, I'm gonna reintroduce this minhag and I'm gonna start living with it. And eventually the mothers-in-law follow suit. So this is, for example, as I said, this was a letter from the Rebbe from the early years about something, I think it was about wearing a shetel or something, but in later years, for example, the Rebbe extended it to, let's say, for example, Neder Shabbos Kodesh, that, for example, a girl will unilaterally in the house decide, let's say, based on what she learned in school, I have to light Shabbos candles, and eventually the mother will go along. There's a famous story also that Rebbe told of a girl from a not yet frum family who learned in Hebrew school about lighting Shabbos Shabbos candles, and she started lighting at home. And after a few weeks, the parents decided, you know what, we can't have the TV on while the Shabbos candles are lit. And so b'slach v'ayis, they became complete Bali Tshuva, all because of this one girl and her candle. So this is Lamal Yusa of Bas Koma V'imakala B'chamosa. Continuing on halachas of going to the bathroom. So we talked about that a person, when he's going to the bathroom in public, in the street or in a field or whatever, as people would sometimes do in those days. I suppose nowadays you could have, if let's say you're on a camping trip or whatever. So we said by day, you have to be far away enough that other people can't see you, the uncovered parts of your body, or behind a fence or whatever. And by night, you don't have to go quite so far. You just have to make sure that nobody actually sees you. So, now this is all as far as defecation, as far as gedolim, but as far as urination, that is actually allowed even in front of many people and even by day, because there's a shash sakana. The Gemara mentions in a few places that a person holds in urine, it can cause him to become sterile. The Gemara mentions it in Bechoros and a few other places, yeah. Yeah, the Gemara mentions over there. Yeah, the Gemara mentions an Amorda, for example, who needed to urinate, and they told him your mother-in-law is coming. In other words, you should be embarrassed to do this. And he says, I'll even do it in her hearing. But Udna, he says, I don't care if she hears. It's important to do it when you gotta go, basically. Yeah, so let's say you stop off on the throughway. Let's say, for example, when you go off to the side. Yeah. Yeah. So a person taka should not act in this way of tsnius and hold back because of the danger when he needs to go. However, he should move off to a side. He shouldn't just do it straight in the middle of the road. He should do it off to the side. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that tells a story actually involving a couple of Jews who have been captured by Goyim, and they're noticing clues on the road that tells them who's ahead of them, and one of them is, they say that there's a caravan ahead of us being led by one Yid and one Goy. How can they tell? Because they can see puddles of urine here and there, and they can see some in the middle of the road and some by the side. So they realize the Goy is shameless and he'll do it in the middle of the road, whereas the Yid has more of a sense of tznius and will do it off to the side. This applies even a woman in front of her little children should also be tzniastic in this regard. Okay, another din in this connection. When a person is going to the bathroom in a place where there are no mechitzes, again, out in an open field or something, so then he has to face towards the south. He has to either face south with his back to the north or the other way around. He should not be facing his backside to west or toward the west or towards the east because of the covered of the Shechina. Because the Shechina is in the west. We talk about the Shechina is in the west. For example, we say that the heavenly bodies bow to Hashem in that they move towards the west and they set in the west, like so to speak, they're bowing to Hashem there. So the Shechina is described as being in the west, and that means the face of the Shechina is towards the east. Which is in fact why throughout Tanakh, directions are always given with east being towards the front and west being towards the back.
So it carries over.
So when a person is going to the bathroom. For the same reason, south is often called Yamin or Taimon in Tanakh. So now, if a person is going to the bathroom with his backside towards the east or towards the west, then it's a lack outside. We're talking about out in an open area. Then it's a lack of respect for the Shechid.
That doesn't carry over into the house.
So that's the next thing, right? So he goes on to say, Al-Tadeva goes on to say, if it's towards a corner, if he's going to have his back is towards the southwest or the southeast or whatever, or any of the corners like that, so then basically it's how much south or north of east or west is it? If it's, for example, if it's, let's say, south, southeast, so it's mostly south and only a little bit east, that would be fine. But if it's east, southeast, let's say, so it's more east than south, then not. Where possible, he goes on to say, the Alter Rebbe goes on to say, where possible, better that he should be facing with his face towards the south, when he's going outdoors, and his back to the north, not the other way around. The reason is that the Alter Rebbe says, because in these countries, he's talking about in Russia and in Poland, which are more or less due north of Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael is basically directly south of them. So if he goes to the bathroom in an open field with his backside towards the south, then it's towards Yerushalayim. In our countries, it would be in our countries in America, it would be different because we're much more west of Yerushalayim. So there it would be more the east west thing, which anyway we're saying you're not supposed to do.
at your house.
But again, all of this is outdoors. In the next fifth alphabet, we'll talk about that when you're indoors, then when you're indoors, that when you're indoors or when you're behind a wall, then it's different. But we'll learn about that next time, Beis Hashem. Rav Chanan Amar.